the most, I'm going to try to say this without crying. So this is the child that I left. I abandoned him, you know, and they find out they're having a baby, and he calls me and he says, "Mom, can you come home? Can you come stay with us? Can you help me with this baby?" And everything that I went through, every emotion and fear and thought, and just the darkest of times, is nothing compares to that moment right there. That moment, I'm never going to arrive anywhere, but if my children can look at me and say, "Will you be a part of my children's life?" You know, after everything that I've done, that's love. You know, that's every reason. If I'm having a bad day, I can definitely look at them. I didn't get clean for them because they weren't talking to me, you know, but they're definitely my motivation.
Man, Rachel, I could talk to you all day. That
Love
is
it. Thank you
so,
for having me.
yeah, that is so wonderful. I'm excited about your success. We're going to keep
Thank you.
following you along. And
Yes.
when you're a grandma and you're just doing so many amazing things, you know,
Thank
starting
you.
over is always an option, and
Always.
always an option. And surrender it to God and let Him fix you.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me on, and I love you so much, and I'm so grateful for you.
I'm grateful for you. Thank you so much.
If you want to share Encouragementology with a friend who needs to know they're not alone in this journey of self-discovery, you can visit Encouragementology.com or anywhere you stream your content to receive this episode and all others. Follow us on Facebook and Instagram for additional encouragement throughout the week. So I challenge you, become aware of your own ups and downs along your journey as you open yourself up to accept and learn from others. Reach out, ask for help, and surrender all. I know you can do it. Thank you for listening to Encouragementology with Kendall Boyson, where we find positive ways to handle some of life's challenges. I stumbled through until the path was clear. That's when I found you, how I wound up here. All I needed was a rock that I can lean on. All you needed was some wind beneath your wings. You are tuned in to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Development and Events Committee will meet on the third Monday of each month at 5:30 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
Tune in to KBOO's Multilingual Music Marathon on March 16th. Join us in paying homage to our planet's linguistic diversity through song and dance. We'll be showcasing music from around the world from 12 p.m. to 1:30 a.m. Again, that's KBOO's Multilingual Music Marathon this Thursday, March 16th, starting at noon. You can hear all our other specials from this winter campaign by going to kboo.fm/thrills.
San Francisco, this is Flashpoints. I'm Dennis Bernstein. Today on the show, a report back on the fight to free journalist and the globally champion political prisoner Mumia Abu-Jamal. We'll speak to an award-winning journalist, and also we'll hear about the battle that the homeless are fighting in the face of torrential rains up and down the coast of California. It is desperate. All this and more coming up straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. This is your daily investigative news magazine. We broadcast every weekday from 5 to 6 over the Pacifica Radio Network. We are live today in San Francisco and Los Angeles, and we are happy to have you along over the Free Speech Pacifica Radio Network. We begin once again. It's almost unbelievable that this we're still having to fight this battle, but that's the way it is. To free prison journalist visionary Mumia Abu-Jamal, who was set up by one of the most corrupt police departments this country has ever seen, and we're still battling, the people are still battling to free this journalist, this activist, this visionary who's now caught the attention of activists and writers and journalists all around the world. We are delighted. It's been too long, but we're delighted to welcome back to these airwaves Professor Author Lynn Washington. He is an expert on the case. He's a professor of journalism at Temple University. There was a major event over the weekend featuring some extraordinary folks. We're going to hear more about that, and we're going to give you a deep update on who Mumia Abu-Jamal is. We're going to remind you, and why perhaps he is still being allowed, I was going to say rot in a prison, but Mumia Abu-Jamal doesn't sit still long enough to rot, even in a prison, even on death row. Lynn Washington, he's been able to keep his spirit whole and alive. Welcome back to Flashpoints.
Hi, Dennis. Thank you for having me.
Well, it's good to have you with us. And I hate to do this again, but I want you to give us the basic, description. Who is Mumia Abu-Jamal? Give us a bit of a thumbnail sketch so folks who don't know might understand what this battle is about.
Well, at the bottom line, Mumia Abu-Jamal is an incredible person. Here's a person who's been locked up for 40 years. About 30 of those years were on death row. While in prison, he's written over 3,000 commentaries, which is more than many journalists produce in their entire career. He's written or co-authored over 12 books, which puts him in the scholar area. He has finished his college degree, got a master's degree, is now working on a PhD. He now speaks two foreign languages, one of which is German, a very difficult language to learn. And a couple of other things that are of relevance. We talk so much about the facts of the Mumia case and the injustices embedded in it, but we kind of forget the face behind the facts. So Mumia is a brother, a relative. He's a father. He's a grandfather. And now he's a widower. His beloved wife passed within the last month or so. So that's who Mumia Abu-Jamal is now. Prior to his arrest on December 9th, 1981, Mumia was one of the most recognized journalists in Philadelphia. In fact, in 1981, the Philadelphia Magazine identified 81 people in 81 to keep an eye on, and they said one was Abu-Jamal because of his eloquent and impassioned journalism. He was known prior to his arrest, but based on his reporting, he was known as the voice of the voiceless, that he would report on and tell the stories of those who are generally left out, pushed into the margins of society. And that phrase, voice of the voiceless, the U.S., the American Society of Professional Journalists, SPJ, has an ethics code. And one of the provisions in the ethics code is journalists should give voice to the voiceless. That phrasing of giving voice to the voiceless, that directive that this organization gave to all journalists around the United States, was not adopted by that organization until the mid-90s. So Abu-Jamal, over 20 years before that became a directive for American journalists, he was already known for doing that. So that's a little thumbnail sketch of who Mumia Abu-Jamal is.
And we should mention that at the time that you're referencing, he was reporting for public radio. He has obviously an extraordinary voice and delivery besides his ability to write amazing commentaries. And he was, let's talk a little bit about the atmospheric pressure at the time that he was arrested. He was reporting, he was a black man. He was reporting in the context of one of the most corrupt police departments in the history of the country. Could you give us a little background on that?
Right. The Philadelphia Police Department is notorious for its brutality. And in fact, in 1979, which would have been 2 years before Mumia's arrest, the federal government filed a lawsuit against the city of Philadelphia, charging the mayor, a number of his top officials in his administration, and all of the top officials in the police department with aiding and abetting police brutality. This was the first suit of its kind ever filed in the history of the United States. So police brutality had to be really, really bad in Philadelphia for such a suit to have taken place. During the 70s, when a guy named Frank Rizzo was the mayor. Frank Rizzo was the former police commissioner. He was elevated to mayor, and he was very adamant that right or wrong, he would defend his police. At one point during the 70s, the Philadelphia police shot and killed more people than the police force in New York. You know, let's be clear, the police force in New York has its own history of brutality. In Philadelphia, New York at that time was about five times larger than Philadelphia. So the per capita deaths by the Philadelphia Police Department was extraordinary. And that did not account for the people who were just shot by police. And I don't mean to minimize just shot, but I'm just saying there were people who were shot, injured, some injured substantially. But then there was the fatalities. And then there were the beatings that went on every day. At least twice a week, I had to do some kind of police brutality story. Somebody would come to the paper that I was working with, and you know, they would be bloodied and bruised, and you know, clothes all torn off. And when I was working for the African American owned newspaper in the city, the Philadelphia Tribune, the people would come to the Tribune asking, you know, for somebody to cover their story, and they had already gone to the dailies, the three dailies in the city. The Inquirer, the Daily News, and the Bulletin, and couldn't even get in the front door. They didn't even want to talk to these victims of police brutality, so they would come down to the Tribune, and we would do stories on them. And Mumia was doing those types of stories, and it wasn't just police brutality, but he was looking at many issues that impact the urban poor. But it wasn't just that he was doing, you know, grassroots-type reporting. I mean, he was a part of a team when he was working with public radio. They covered the visit of the Pope to Philadelphia, and that team coverage won a major broadcast award. I think it was the Armstrong Award. He interviewed, yes, Bob Marley. He interviewed Julius Erving, who at the time was an outstanding basketball player in Philadelphia, a professional basketball player. So he had a range of coverage.
Go on, please.
Yeah. But what I was just going to say, that era in Philadelphia, the 1970s going into the early 80s, was dominated by the issue of abusive policing, from false arrests to fatal shootings.
And one of the things that sort of intensified the level of the brutality was the bombing by the police department of a suburban house that was owned, I guess, or lived in by the MOVE group. And Mumia Abu-Jamal, I guess, wasn't all that sanguine with the idea that you had the Philadelphia Police Department dropping bombs in suburbia. That began a whole different level of Mumia's life when he took on that issue and beyond. You want to talk about how he tangled with the police and how he ended up on death row? It certainly wasn't because he killed anybody.
Well, during the 70s, there was an ongoing battle between the Philadelphia police and an organization called MOVE. They were a predominantly black organization, self-described revolutionaries. They lived a counterculture type lifestyle. So they were kind of on the margins of society. But one of the things that they would do is that they would not back down from Rizzo's police force. So there was a lot of fights. I mean, fist fights, and then those battles escalated from, say, 1976, when there was a confrontation and the police, a police officer allegedly stomped on a MOVE baby and killed it. And things just started escalating. So we get to early 1978. Rizzo wanted to get the MOVE out of a compound that they were living in near the University of Pennsylvania, an area that they wanted to gentrify and ultimately did, not just the University of Pennsylvania and Drexel, but, you know, the powers that be financially, they wanted to gentrify that area. And things culminated into a shootout on August 8th, 1978. And during that shootout, you had one of the first televised assaults by police officers on a unarmed person. One of the leaders of the MOVE organization was savagely beaten. And this was 12 years or more before Rodney King. And Mumia saw that, and he was, it affected him. And so he started doing more and more reportage on MOVE. And that reportage kind of ran him afoul with some of the organizations that he was working for. So as we flash forward into 1981, many of the stations that he had worked for, because of his efforts to do more coverage on MOVE, and some of the coverage, you know, crossed the line in terms of the veneer of objectivity that journalists are supposed to maintain. He, you know, ran afoul with some of the owners. So as a result of that, he wasn't working full time. He was working part time, but as a diligent individual, one who, you know, took his role as husband and father to heart, he was going to make money for his family. So he was driving a cab. He was driving a cab on December 9th, 1981. He goes to leave off a fare and get a bite to eat in a nightlife area of the city. He sees his brother being beaten by a police officer. He goes over to see what's going on. And within a minute or so, the police officer's dead. Mumia's shot. Police arriving on the scene beat him, who Mumia is now injured by a policeman's bullet, injured critically. Police beat him. They admitted on the witness stand on some of the court proceedings that they accidentally rammed his head into a telephone pole 7 times. You accidentally do that once, maybe 3 times, but not 7. That's conscientious, right? He goes to the hospital. Yeah. They beat him in the hospital. And, you know, pre-op and post-op, he's beaten in the hospital. He's charged with murder. He has a trial in 1982 before a notorious pro-police judge who actually, on the eve of the trial, was overheard saying that he planned to help prosecutors fry the N-word, but he didn't use N-word, he used that word. So you could see that, one, it was racially biased, very odious to use that term, but also it was biased in terms of him making a pro-prosecution posture, which is in total violation of every thing a judge is supposed to be. Judges are supposed to be independent arbiters, not one who put their thumb, and in the instance of Judge Szabo, actually put his whole ball fist on the scales of justice to make sure that Abu-Jamal was convicted. He was convicted, sentenced to death row. He languished on death row for about 28 years. Then the deuce of them appeals, they found one fault. Amazing. Of all of the faults in the case, they only found one in federal courts. And they said that the judge did not give proper instructions to the jury during the death penalty proceeding. And they set aside his death penalty, and the prosecution decided not to seek the reimposition of the death penalty because that would have required them to hold a court proceeding where new evidence could be brought out. Now, the new evidence would just be brought out, but the proceeding would just be to determine whether he goes back to death row or goes into what Pennsylvania has as life in prison without parole, meaning you're in prison until you die. And in an effort to make sure that the new evidence that was there, evidence that had been suppressed conscientiously by police and prosecutors at the original trial and throughout the proceeding, they opted not to retrying or, you know, try to resentence him, and they allowed his sentence to be converted. So I guess for like the past 10 years or so, he's been in general population, and he's been suffering a lot of medical problems. He had hepatitis C, which led to kidney problems and liver problems. He almost died. The state would not give him treatment for the hepatitis C. The treatment that they were giving him was causing incredible skin problems. I mean, he was itching all the time. He was scaly. Almost looked like reptilian when he had so many scales. And his fight to get treatment for himself enabled all the other inmates in Pennsylvania's prison system, which at that point was thousands of people who had been infected by hepatitis C, they were able to get treatment. The state of Pennsylvania was willing to allow people who contracted this, you know, horrible disease to die rather than to give them the treatment. So many of the initiatives that Mumia has made have helped others more so than they have helped him. So now he's still in prison, and he has a new round of appeals that is really interesting. It's clear cut. You don't have to be a lawyer or a law professor or a judge to see that he needs to either at least get a new hearing, if not a new trial. But the evidence is of such substance that he should be released directly from prison. And there have been instances where people who have had misconduct by police and prosecutors of a much lower degree than exists in the Mumia case to be released directly from prison. But the courts have so far refused to recognize Mumia's rights and give him the same relief that they've given to others. Thus, I coined a phrase about 12 years ago called the Mumia exception. The law means the law except when it applies to Mumia. Just to give you a quick example, in 1992, there was a guy who was on death row, with, like Mumia. He was convicted in a high-profile murder case, and very similar to Mumia's situation in that, you know, this murder had been the subject of books and TV shows, and, you know, it was very, very high-profile. And the prosecutors withheld some incredible evidence of innocence from this guy. They withheld it for 2 years. And the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, ruling on this guy's appeal, said that that act of withholding that evidence was for 2 years was such a gross violation of fundamental fairness and fair trial rights that it would be unconstitutional to retry him. So they released him directly from death row. And but they wouldn't give the same kind of relief to Mumia. And interestingly enough, this guy who was released directly from death row He had the help of a jailhouse attorney, jailhouse lawyer, to help him with his appeals and everything. And that jailhouse lawyer was Mumia Abu-Jamal. Since his incarceration, he's become a very adept jailhouse lawyer. He's helped a lot of people get out, but he hasn't been successful. Although the elements of the appeals should have granted him relief, you know, 20 years ago. But the state is the state of Pennsylvania and the whole apparatus, political and police and law enforcement, are arrayed against him. So he's the victim of institutional bias, not just individual biases, but institutional bias.
And it's bipartisan. It's bipartisan, oh, yeah. Institutional, right? Bipartisan. Everybody, oh, yeah, likes to talk about bipartisan. This death sentence, this life sentence, death sentence, is clearly something that the Democrats, the Bidens of this world, won't even go near. Just like they won't go near Leonard Peltier, because when it's a choice between truth and following orders of the Police Benevolent Association, everybody knows what these politicians do, no matter how corrupt the police in Philadelphia are. Am I overstating the case?
Oh, no, not at all. I mean, when we look at, say, the case of Leonard Peltier, the judge who sentenced him, as well as, I think, the prosecutor who tried him, said that, you know, he should be released. He was treated unfairly. What has kept him in prison for all these decades is that every time he comes up for a new trial or a new appeal proceeding or even consideration for some kind of parole, FBI agents, the FBI Agent Association, comes out and demands that, you know, he get no relief. In fact, they've held marches to keep him in prison. Parallel to that, when Mumia has been subjected to incredible interference and harassment by the Philadelphia Fraternal Order of Police, which is the Philadelphia's police union, which has a propensity to back candidates like George Wallace, the segregationist candidate in the late 60s, backed Richard Nixon and backed Donald Trump twice.
You know, now the now National Book Award winner Martina Spada was commissioned by National Public Radio back a few years to do a poem, and he decided to write a poem about Mumia Abu-Jamal. And the liberal, progressive National Public Radio censored the poem. And I know they did it because I called right in right after they did it, and I spoke to the assistant producer, and she said, yeah, they didn't want us to run this. Police power.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And prior to National Public Radio censoring that poet, Mumia was slated to do a series of commentaries on life in prison. So who would you want to talk about life in prison? A scientist who works in the Arctic or the Antarctic who has no experience with prison? You want to talk to a prisoner. And the reality is that a lot of the people in prison are not very articulate. They have, low IQs and that sort of thing. So here we have a unique person who could uniquely tell that story. And NPR was getting ready to run his commentaries, the National and the Philadelphia Fraternal Order of Police went they just went bonkers on it. And they got a U.S. Senator, one Robert Dole, to get on the floor of the Senate and just start railing against NPR for, you know, how dare they bring a cop killer in and blah, 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 blah. And NPR backed off, sheepishly backed off. And that attitude, you know, persisted when they, you know, censored the poet. But, you know, it's so ridiculous. You know, you can't have a cop killer doing commentaries on life in prison. So are you saying it's okay to have a child molester or a white-collar corporate criminal? So it just shows you the level of censorship in a country that supposedly holds freedom of the press and free speech in esteem. It just shows you the endemic corruption and corrupted behaviors in America that go on daily, and we kind of give it a wink and a nod and keep pushing while we criticize other countries and send armies into other countries to make sure that they uphold democracy. Well, we don't have democracy here. Like Malcolm X said, American democracy is disguised hypocrisy. And that's what we see, you know, in the Mumia case.
It's interesting, Lynn. These days, you know, if you're a black person, all you have to do is be pulled over for a non-violation, and you can be executed. The word is shut your mouth, keep your hands on the dashboard, look forward.
Mm-hmm.
You can get killed for doing nothing. So you can understand why the white power structure would be afraid of somebody such as Mumia Abu-Jamal, who is a freaking genius when it comes to journalism, commentary, visionary thinking. It is extraordinary. It is really, wouldn't you say, Lynn, it's an example in the white power structure's fear, just like with Leonard Peltier, fear of powerful indigenous and leaders of color. That's what it comes down to, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. And we've seen over the years repeated efforts to crush those who are perceived by the system to be threats or people who could rally. Let's remember that infamous memo that J. Edgar Hoover put out through the COINTEL program, that they didn't want to have a rise of a black messiah. This was in the wake of the killing of Malcolm X and Martin Luther King, but they wanted to make sure that nobody else would be able to, you know, rise to that level of popularity and be able to effectuate the change. You know, Dennis, it's interesting. You bring up a point about the bipartisan repression of Mumia. The current appeal is is a prime example of this bipartisanship, right? The issues in this current appeal is evidence that the prosecutors withheld for 36 years, okay? In the United States, there's a U.S. Supreme Court opinion called Brady versus Maryland. They call it Brady issue. And it essentially says that the prosecution has a duty and a responsibility to turn over all evidence of guilt as well as all evidence of innocence to the defense before the trial. They say in a timely manner. Now, I would think that you don't need to have a law degree or even a history degree to say that 36 years is not timely, right? So in Pennsylvania, we have the Brady standard from the U.S. Supreme Court. The Pennsylvania Supreme Court has issued similar types of rulings that what prosecutors are supposed to do in terms of turning over information. The rules of professional conduct that cover lawyers in Pennsylvania is a whole, you know, like dozens of pages in terms of what they should do and what they shouldn't do. There's a special section in there. It's called the Special Section for Prosecutors, Section 3.8. And of the four things that they say prosecutors should do, one is that prosecutors should make timely disclosures of all evidence that is either inculpatory guilt or exculpatory innocence. And further, in the Pennsylvania Code, there's a provision where prosecutors are supposed to turn over information. Now, over the years, prosecutors have gone into court and objected to different legal proceedings from Abu-Jamal by saying, we've turned over everything, we've turned over everything, we've turned over everything. Well, here's an interesting thing with this current appeal. This evidence that I have been referencing that they kept for 36 years, this evidence was not found in a trunk of an abandoned car or in somebody's basement. It was found in the office of the district attorney by the current district attorney, a guy named Larry Krasner, who is seen, and rightfully so, as a very progressive DA. And Krasner, around 2018, December, he was moving around the office. He had just been elected months before that. So he just wanted to see the lay of the office. And they found a floor between two floors, like a subfloor. And most of the people in the office didn't even know that that floor existed. So he goes into a storage closet, finds all of these old files, six boxes of which had information on Abu Jamal. Now, of relevance, there's three very key pieces of information that came out of those boxes. There were two, and like only two witnesses during the trial that positively said that they saw Mumia shoot and kill Officer Daniel Faulkner. One was a cab driver, and one was a prostitute. Without getting too deep into it, I mean, the reality is that neither of them were actually there, and evidence indicates that they weren't. But let's just take their story that they saw it. So the cab driver, weeks after the trial, a handwritten note to the prosecutor saying, "I've tried to reach you by telephone. I can't get you on the telephone, so I decided to write a note. When are you going to give me the money that you promised? When are you going to give me the money?" Now, witnesses, prosecution witnesses, are paid a fee, you know, to come in to testify, you know, just like a maintenance kind of a fee. They're put up in hotels. All of the food and everything is taken care of. So what money is he talking about? He apparently was talking about, "You promised me money for in exchange for my testimony," which should be automatic, you know, let Mumia out of jail. The prostitute, there was a series of memos between the Mumia's trial prosecutor and other prosecutors in the office to make sure that this particular person got favorable treatment. So after the trial, the few outstanding cases that the person had were dropped. And before the trial, this person was in prison in Massachusetts, and Philadelphia authorities went up and got her released from prison to come back to Philadelphia. And to show you how they coddled this woman over the years, a few years after Mumia's trial and conviction, she was on trial for an armed robbery. She robbed the person and stole their car. She robbed the person at knife point and stole their car. The judge was going to not give her bail because, you know, she had all of these, a long series of about 40 arrests, and many of those arrests were related to failure to appear in court. A police officer comes in, actually a detective, and said that she's an important witness in a case. Could she sign her own bail? And the judge agreed, you know, because the prosecution wanted it, the police department wanted it. They let this person sign their own bail and walk out of the courtroom on an armed robbery case. And the woman was never seen in the court again. And I guess around the early 2000s, there was an appeal that Mumia had filed, and they were trying to find this person. And all of a sudden, the prosecution said, "Oh, well, she's dead. And here's her death certificate. The Social Security number didn't match. The fingerprints didn't match." So they disappeared this woman, right? Wow. And then there's another piece of evidence in that file. Yeah, I'm sorry.
No, we're just about out of time, but I guess...
Okay, but I'm just saying... But what I want to say is this, that the prosecutor in the city of Philadelphia, the district attorney, found this evidence. Now, this prosecutor, I said, is a very progressive prosecutor. He's exonerated about 29 people. And from 2018, when he found this evidence, to today, there have been 33 people that have been exonerated from wrongful convictions in Philadelphia. 31 of those 33, one of the elements in the exoneration was withheld evidence, the prosecution withholding evidence. So here this prosecutor, a Democrat and a liberal, will recognize and condemn prosecutors withholding evidence in 31 cases. Yet in Mumia's case, the prosecutor is in court fighting strenuously for him not to be given any kind of relief, because they're saying that, yes, we withheld this evidence for 36 years, but it really didn't hurt him in the court. So, yes, our witnesses looked like they lied and cheated, but it didn't hurt him, his case, which is preposterous. Yeah. But it just shows you the institutional level of oppression that Abu Jamal has sustained for 40 years.
It's horrific. Listen, Lynn, I can't tell you how much we appreciate the information and the work that you've done on this case, not giving it up all the way through. We have been speaking with Professor Lynn Washington. We're talking about the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal. Lynn Washington, Professor Washington, teaches at Temple University. He's an award-winning journalist, and he's been covering Abu-Jamal's case for 4 decades. Wow. Lynn, thanks for coming back. Thanks for all the extraordinary work you've done on this case. This is, you know, this is not full of rewards, but the people appreciate the fact that this genius of journalism is being suppressed, still imprisoned, because the powers that be are afraid of the truth, and they're certainly terrified of black truth tellers. Thanks, Lynn. We'll talk to you soon. Please keep us posted on this case.
Thank you so much for having me, and take care. Bye-bye.
You're absolutely welcome. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. We went a little over, but we have a very important segment coming up on the torrential rains and what's happening with the folks who are hungry or forced to live outside. And are not getting any help, particularly in South Bay around Santa Cruz, but up and down the coast. We're going to take a 2-minute break, and we'll be back with Keith McHenry. Stay with us. Flashpoints on KPFA Pacifica Radio in the San Francisco Bay Area, up and down the West Coast, and we're happy to have you along with us on Free Speech Radio, the People's Radio Network, Pacifica. We're now joined by Keith McHenry. He does a regular segment with us. We call it Food Fight, but these are incredibly tough times, Keith McHenry. The waters are flowing, and the folks outside are in grave danger. You want to talk a little bit about sort of what it looks like on the ground there? I know you've been taking a look at what's going on up and down California, but why don't you start with Santa Cruz, where you're based, and what are the issues, what are the concerns?
Well, you know, in Santa Cruz, there are hundreds of people that are not able to get into the few normal shelters that they have here. So there's they live outside, and they can't get even into, like, you know, out of the weather at all. And the city of Santa Cruz actually has a policy: if you're caught in a parking garage trying to get out of the rain, the police come in and force you back out into the rain. And that's normally the case anyway, but now with the rains are unbelievable down here, and it's just shocking that to think that a city government and a county government, Santa Cruz County, would not open some of their facilities, which are large empty spaces. For instance, there's a Warrior Stadium, and there's also the new mayor, Fred Keeley, is like this big Warriors fan, and the stadium just sits there empty. You know, tonight it'll be empty, like it has been through all the atmospheric rivers, and then also there's a Veterans Hall, which will be empty tonight again, as it has been through the atmospheric rivers, and there's Civic Auditorium. There's enough space for people to get in and out of the rain. So what they have offered, however, is a place for 25 of these hundreds of people to stay in and out of the rain from the hours of 8 o'clock tonight to 8 tomorrow morning. And the staff there at that little shelter, Depot Park Shelter, were arguing with the city government and the county to allow them to stay open 24 hours so at least those 25 people could stay out of the rain. But they refuse. And we did a campaign to try to kind of get public support to demand that the city open these empty buildings during this time. Because you just imagine, I'm out in the rain in the middle of the day doing food not bombs. And when I come, I am soaking wet, even in rain gear. And I come to my, you know, come indoors at the end of my, you know, doing this all day. And I can take off all my clothes and everything and get into new clothes. But hundreds of other people have to stand in this rain 24 hours a day. And there's no possible way for them to even take their clothes off and put on dry clothes. Because whatever clothes they might have in their backpack is also soaking wet. And this is, I call it a special kind of cruelty, because we've been lobbying and protesting for all through the winter, trying to get these facilities available, at least during the atmospheric storms. And so they did open one Civic Auditorium, and their assumption was that housed people who were losing their ability to get to their housing or did lose their housing during the earlier atmospheric rivers would come down from the hills and stay at Civic Auditorium. Although what turned out was that one night, a lot of the people living on the streets downtown heard about this at our meal, and they went there and filled the entire auditorium with our blue pup tents, actually, and stuff that they brought in and so on. And when they found out it wasn't really going to be the good residents of Santa Cruz using this emergency shelter, they just shut it down and forced everybody back out into the rain, and they have failed to reopen. At the same time, when we're making that plea to the government to allow people to just get in out of the rain during the atmospheric rivers, they sent us a letter threatening to arrest us if we tried to feed the homeless in the parking garage 10, which is what we had agreed with the city chief of police to do. And then they actually sent a lot of cops there way before we were even ready to set up to make sure we couldn't get into the garage, that homeless people couldn't get in out of the rain. And then we thought, well, we'll do a protest at City Hall, because there's awnings around City Hall. At least we could serve food under there and have a protest demanding that the Civic Auditorium across the street be opened. And they sent a whole raft of cops there and threatened to arrest us for having a rally in support of getting people in out of the rain. And so far, we only know of two people who have died from this. I don't think they were homeless people, but it's just so cruel. It's the most cruel thing to intentionally leave hundreds of people standing in this rain. And either there's like this class blindness, or this is overt evil cruelty. And I'm sad to say, I think it's the cruelty that's really what it's about.
Sounds like cruelty, Keith McHenry. Now, how far is Santa Cruz from Silicon, what we call Silicon Valley?
Well, we are on the other side of the hill, so it's like a 30-minute drive to Silicon Valley from here. if you can get there in this rain, it might well be cut off by the storms again, as has happened repeatedly. But there is a regular parade of Google buses, for instance, that pick up employees to go over the hill, and there is a lot of Google executives that live in Santa Cruz, including the chief attorney, Miss Prado, who lives on the west side, who actually has, her husband is the treasurer of this anti-homeless organization called Take Back Santa Cruz. And we ended up intercepting, we got in the Public Records Act request emails showing that they're trying to get my car towed for some reason, because I'm supporting the homeless. And the president of the homeless union, Alicia Cool's RV, where she's living with her, where she was living with her three children and her husband. And so they have a weekly meeting to determine how to attack homeless people in Santa Cruz. And, you know, so these are some of the largest institutions. And they also have, like, huge offices in Santa Cruz. And this is also true of Facebook employees, of
okay, let me interrupt, Keith. Thanks for, you know, setting that up for us. And so how much, it's interesting, it looks like the Biden administration is very sympathetic to making sure that everybody is made whole, billions of millions made whole. So your thoughts on the rush to bail out Silicon Bank land while letting the homeless in the hordes, and this goes up and down the coast, risk life and limb to try and get through torrential rains while hungry and homeless. There's a lot of attention going to that little bank and no attention to the men. Go on, please.
None of the local media or national media is talking about the suffering. When I say hundreds of people just in Santa Cruz, that's in the town of Santa Cruz. There's hundreds of others in Santa Cruz County. There's there's thousands of people within 5 mile drive of the headquarters of Silicon Valley Bank who are having to survive this in San Jose and in all around there. It's like, it's outrageous. And they could have easily provided at least emergency shelter through this. The amount of money they have, of course, they got billions of dollars, and here this bank is, they're being bailed out within from Friday to now. And that we've had years of us struggling to try to get adequate shelter in this area, and it just does not happen. It is criminal, and it's obviously intentional. So the super wealthy, they get the money right away. The rest of us, who are victims of their economic policies, we're left to stand in torrential rains and face life and death situation. There will be people, sadly, will discover that are living outside, who will be crushed by trees that are falling because of the loose soil. People, let them eat cake type of situation here, but even more brutal. And it is amazing that there's I just posted my essay called A Special Kind of Cruelty that I put out on anarchist cook dot blog space, on WordPress. And it got taken down instantly off of Facebook. Didn't even survive.
All right, Keith, could you adjust yourself? We're losing you a little bit. I'd like you to sort of adjust your, maybe we can get a better sound. And Reed, do you have the piece in front of you?
Yeah, I do. I have it. It's called, and it could be that the weather is really bad, because even listening to the last segment, it was really weird. So it could be that it's not anything but the rain's already impacting the telephone lines. But a special kind of cruelty, forcing the homeless of Santa Cruz into the harsh torrents of the atmospheric river. And so the city of Santa Cruz is forcing hundreds of people who are homeless to stand out in the atmospheric river, Just imagine standing day after day in these torrents of rain with no way to change into dry clothes. These people could be spared this suffering if the city opened empty public buildings like the Civic Auditorium, the Veterans Hall, and the Warrior Stadium for 24 hours a day during these deadly storms. But they have refused. The one emergency shelter is only open for 25 people from the hours of 8 p.m. to 8 a.m., leaving those few lucky people to spend their day standing huddled against the rain in the doorways of a failed business. See, that's the other thing. People are using the failed businesses of Pacific Avenue to shelter in. And then the city of Santa Cruz is not only failing to provide safe shelter during the atmospheric river. On March 9th, 2023, the city threatened to arrest Food Not Bombs if we shared our meal next to parking garage 10, forcing people to stand in the downpour to get their only daily hot meal provided to the homeless during the 3 years of the pandemic lockdowns. This sure is an odd way to honor the city's one volunteer organization who shared food and survival gear every day since March 14th, 2020. On June 29th, 2021, the city of Santa Cruz announced that they would receive $14.5 million from the state to fund their homeless response. So far, there is little evidence that this has provided any assistance, and it sure has not been used to provide emergency shelter from the brutal atmospheric river. So it's a pretty long essay, but the other points that I want to make in that, at the same time, food stamps, you know, if you're not on food stamps, you didn't realize that you just lost hundreds of dollars, you know, like you might lose $200 for your family this in April of food stamps. They're already cutting food stamps now, but across the country, there's like millions of Americans that are losing their food stamps. And top of the bank failures that are happening, which are, you know, in the Bay Area, there's nearly 200,000 employees have lost their jobs in the past year. 50,000 lost their jobs in January alone. And so people are actually starting to, we're seeing people living in Teslas now. So this is a really incredible Dickens.
You said you saw people living in Teslas? Living in Teslas?
Yeah, there's people that eat at Food Not Bombs that live in their Tesla. This is the reality. So unless you're like Roe Conner and these people, Silicon Valley Bank CEO took out over $3 billion in stock the day before it crashed and gave bonuses to the executives. And meanwhile, employees in the high-tech industry are losing their jobs and therefore losing their apartments, are failing to pay their mortgages, and are ending up becoming homeless themselves. I mean, this is psychotic. And yet there's not, you know, we've known that millions, you know, the Princeton eviction project said there are 40 million American families were facing eviction due to the pandemic, and yet, you know, other than rental bans against evictions during that time, now the doors are wide open. The pandemic relief is gone. The eviction moratoriums are gone. And the economy's crashing, and there still isn't a plan. We're a democratically run state in a country that has a democratic president and who had 2 years of being in office where they could have passed anything through the democratically controlled House and Senate, and we're still waiting for some kind of action, and it looks like that action is going to come way too late for thousands and thousands, millions of people. And it's got to be cruelty. It's got to be, if I'm sitting here in Santa Cruz with virtually no resources, and I know this, you know the people in power with money know this, and they're intentionally not doing anything to help alleviate the crisis of the homeless and right on their doorstep. It is criminal. It's completely criminal.
That's the voice of Keith McHenry. We're sorry for the difficult sound quality. We're in the middle of atmospheric rivers and folks trying to struggle outside, trying to save some lives in terms of what could happen with folks who are facing this weather outdoors. Keith, it's amazing that you're on this. We just have a minute or two left. What are you hearing? What's happening down south, up north? We know that Food Not Bombs has locations all across the state, all around the world, really. But what are you hearing? Are other folks facing the same kinds of struggles that you're seeing there in Santa Cruz? Very quickly.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's been a disaster. In Isla Vista, Food Not Bombs, they've got a similar crisis where they're not putting people in emergency shelters.
Thanks for listening to KVOO Portland, 90.7 FM in the Portland metro area and all over the world at KBOO.FM.
KBOO Community Radio is hiring a full-time development director. This position leads all fundraising campaigns and makes sure activities